Okay, we are back in Bava Metzia, the middle gate, as we said in the first class, the middle gate, which is talking about different kinds of interpersonal relationships and things that, in our case, monetary issues. And we've been talking about something called Hashavas Aveda, or Hashavat Aveda, the returning of a lost object. And we've been noting that there's a certain tug of war, right? There's a tension on the one hand in maintaining the actual lost item, but also in making sure that it's used, right? Part of its maintenance is its use. And we talked about different materials that could do that based on the Mishnah. But what we really started focusing on in the last class, and what we'll continue today, is the last line of the Mishnah on Chaf Tes Amud Beis, which you don't have in your paper that's in front of you, because we're going to focus on the Gemara part, which is on Lamed Amud Aleph. But we had said that there are sometimes that, let me get my violin in tune here. There are sometimes where one is not obligated. Well, we talked about this last time. One is either not obligated or obligated not to, right, depending on how you look at it, to not pick up the lost item. And that depends on one of two factors. If you simply read the Mishnah, you would think that it's dependent on the actual item. Because the Mishnah had said, "Matza sak okupa v'chol davar she'en darko litol." If you find a bag or a box which is not normally taken, so then harezeh, what was it? Lo yitol. Behold, you should not, or cannot, do not have to, or should not take it. So, if one were to read that line, you would think to themselves, as we did originally, because we're not going to preconceive any notions here. Then you would think that the reason one doesn't have to or shouldn't pick it up is because it's an insignificant item. And the item itself, it's like a little baggie that you get from, you know, One Stop or Kroger or one of these little, you know, flimsy bags. I happen to like the One Stop bags. I think they're a little thicker. But either way. So you would think that it's one of those bags. I'm not sure if we have any of the page that we're on left.
Okay.
Yeah. Sorry, these are all pages that we're not using tonight. That you would think that that the source of the leniency or the source of the absolving of the obligation is based on the insignificant nature of the item. But then we saw the Gemara asks the question: what is the situation, Ketzad? What is the situation where you would get one of these absolvings? That you would not be obligated. This time that you can ignore the obligation of Hashavas Aveda. So if you remember, the Gemara had said in the second wide line on Lamed, right? The second wide line is going to be towards the bottom always. So the line starts with Haya, right? So the Gemara asks, what's the situation? So Haya Kohen v'hiba beis hakvaros. What's the situation? One is a halachic category, that it's a Kohen who is looking at a lost item, and that lost item is in a cemetery. So what's the obvious problem?
Kohen
can't go into a cemetery. So now you have a tug of war. You have a tension. On the one hand, you have the prohibition of going into a cemetery, and you have the mitzvah of returning a lost item. So the Gemara says that's one of the situations where you don't have to pick it up. Now, to wrap it back into what we just said, to connect to what we were just talking about, is that a situation of an insignificant item?
No.
It could be a smartphone. It could be tefillin. It could be something very important.
The small box.
Right. Guess what it is. So even if it's the most significant item, it doesn't matter. Meaning that when the Mishnah says it's something that's not normally taken, it has nothing to do with the thing. It has to do with the person. And one of the categories of people who don't have to take something is a Kohen when he can't go into a certain place. Right? So as we said last week in Gemara terminology, or in Brisker terminology more specifically, this is the distinction between a Chefza and a Gavra. The Chefza is, when we talk about any interaction, are we talking about the thing that is being acted upon, or are we talking about the actor? So when it comes to the situation, we originally thought maybe it was the thing that was acted upon, that it's the flimsy bag, which is not significant enough to require someone to necessitate an obligation to pick it up. But now we're saying, no, it's not about the chefza, it's not about the object itself, but rather it's about the gavra. Gavra means person. It's about the person, and the person himself is in a situation where they wouldn't be someone to go pick that item up. For instance, category number one, a halachic reason. So for that, the kohen in the cemetery, he would not be obligated. So that's situation number one. What's situation number two?
Zakein.
Oh, haya zakein. Ve'ina lefi chvodo. What does that mean?
It's his dignity.
Not necessarily that they're an old person, but someone who is experienced and wise, right? And they're respected. It's beneath their dignity to go pick it up. And now I talked last week, Sarah asked, is this talking about, well, she talked about the next category, but is this talking about some kind of, you know, haughty, egoistic person? This is beneath my dignity to pick this item up. So we said, no, it's not really talking about that. Because as we said before, the Mishnah gives us a headline, which is these are things that aren't picked up. So why are these things not picked up? Because it's not normal for a person to pick them up. We only require someone to go beyond their personal property, to take someone else's property, to protect someone else's property within the realm of something they would usually do for their own property. So if it's a situation where they themselves wouldn't pick it up, they don't have to then extend more than they would do in a normal circumstance. And so therefore, in a situation where you have a zakein, she'enu lefi chvodo, it doesn't mean, oh, there's a lost item, but I'm above that. What it means is, if I would see my own item, or if I would see something like that that's available to me, I wouldn't normally pick it up, so I'm not obligated to go pick it up for somebody else. Meaning it's just an absolving of that requirement, of that obligation. And similarly we said, and this makes that question even stronger, O shehaisa malacha shalom meruba mishal chavero. Or if the work that person does is greater than the item's worth. So this is that's within Rashi's understanding, right? Rashi had said sheivato b'hashav ata, that you're going to nullify with your giving it back. Meruba al demei ha'aveda. It's greater, the amount of work or the amount of income that one would get, the revenue that a person would get through their job. If that revenue is greater than the worth of the item itself, so therefore they're not obligated. Not because they're such a big shot lawyer, and because this is, you know, I'm losing money, I'm on the clock. Not because of that. But because in a normal circumstance, that person wouldn't feel the need to go do it. So when it's somebody else's item, he also doesn't have the obligation, therefore, to extend beyond what he would do for himself in a neutral sort of situation. So these are the three categories of types of people who are not obligated to pick up an item. Not because of the item, but because of their own relationship with picking things up. Number one, we had a halachic category, the kohen in the cemetery. Number two, we had a respect category, a kavod category, of a person who's older in years or wiser. And then number three, we had a monetary category, someone who it's not worth their while. Not obviously, mitzvahs are worth their while. But again, we're not talking about any kind of weighing of the importance of a mitzvah here. We're talking about what a person typically does. So we had said that we're leaving us off with a cliffhanger. What was the cliffhanger? The cliffhanger was the Gemara's question. So if we look at the next three words of the Gemara, the beginning of the fourth wide line. So the Gemara asks, Lamai itzrich kra. So I'll tell you, first of all, to take a step back for a second. They say about Daf Yomi, and no one here is, I don't think, anyone here learning Daf Yomi?
No.
I assume yet. Not yet. So they say about Daf Yomi that there's a certain divine, you know, providence about Daf Yomi. So this morning's Daf, literally this morning, was a quote of this Gemara that I'm about to say. This quote, there are 2,711 pages in Hebrew terms of Dafim. Right? There are 2,711. And Dafka, this morning, we read the quote of this Gemara in Brachos. Because as you know, the Gemara uses different snippets of different Gemaras to prove different things. So this morning it was talking about whether or not a person could use their own seichel to override a mitzvah. So for instance, one of the situations in the Gemara this morning was, this is Brachos Daf Yud Tes, Brachos 19. The situation was, let's say a person is walking in the middle of the marketplace, and he realizes that he's wearing shatnez, he's wearing kilayim. He has a mixture of wool and linen in his clothing. So he says to himself, on the one hand, it's an Isser D'Oraisa. This is a biblical prohibition. I can't be wearing these clothes. On the other hand, that'd be so embarrassing if I took my clothes off right here. So the Gemara says, you can't make your own logical jumping jacks. If Hashem says a mitzvah is a mitzvah, a biblical commandment, that there's a lot of redefining in terms of biblical commandment. But if it's a biblical commandment, you can't use your thumbs to get out of it. Right? You can't logic it away. So one of the examples is a Kohen who is going to look at to get a lost item. It says, what about this Gemara in Bava Metzia? Don't you know the Gemara in Bava Metzia that they're learning in the Wednesday night class where it says that a Kohen who's looking at a lost item doesn't have to go to the cemetery to get it? But wait a second, you're using your thumbs. He has an obligation to go get the lost item. So the Gemara says, no, that's because of a pasuk. The pasuk says it. If it wasn't for the pasuk, the implication is that he would have to go get it. But it's the pasuk comes to tell me, the verse comes to tell me that he doesn't have to. And that's why the Gemara this morning said, that's why that's a bad example. That's a bad example of a person that doesn't have to do a mitzvah. Because the reason he's not doing it is because the pasuk itself. Yes, there's a biblical obligation to return an item. But there's also a biblical obligation for him not to return the item. Or at least a permissibility to not return the item. So that was this morning's daf. And the question really becomes, what do you need this pasuk for? If you remember last week, we said that you would need the pasuk because of halachic arithmetic. What was the math that we went through last week? Does anyone remember? You don't remember, Elaine? No. What was the math? The math was you have, on the one hand, a mitzvah asay, a positive commandment, something that you proactively have to do, and you have a lotasay, a negative commandment, something you have to refrain from. And what's the situation here? You have, on the one hand, the obligation to return an item. That's active. That's a positive commandment. Go do that. And then on the other hand, you have a lotasay, a negative commandment. Don't go into the cemetery. And what's the rule? The rule usually is, that a positive commandment can push away a negative commandment. We quoted last week, if you remember from the Ramban in Parshas Yisrael, which we'll get to in a few weeks in the Torah, where he says the reason based on Zachor and Shomer, B'divar Echad Nemru, by Shabbos, the reason is because the logic behind that concept is that love trumps fear. Love overcomes fear. And when it comes to a proactive mitzvah, you do that out of love. You do something because you want to do it. You get out of bed in the morning because you love what you're about to do. And what about a negative commandment? You don't do that because you're afraid of the consequences. That's obviously very simplified and whatever, but that's what the Ramban says. The positive commandment outweighs the negative commandment, pushes it away, because love is greater than fear. To have a relationship with someone, and specifically with God, on the basis of love, as opposed to the basis of fear, is more important. And therefore, we said that the arithmetic already adds up. That one should, the Kohen should, go into the cemetery. He should go into the cemetery, ase docha lo tase, do the positive mitzvah of returning a lost item, and that should outweigh the negative commandment of becoming impure by defilement with a dead body. The truth is that I tricked you. That's the truth. Because the truth is that that's not the only arithmetic in this equation. There are more aspects to these mitzvos than just those two. And here the Gemara is going to spell those out. So the Gemara says, Lamai itzrich kra. We had said that the reason you need a pasuk is because, Aseh docha lo taseh. All else being equal, the Kohen should go in and do it. Because the positive commandment outweighs the negative. That's why you needed the pasuk to say he doesn't have to do it. But comes the Gemara and says, why do you need a pasuk? Wait a second. Ilema le kohen vehibe beis haklaros. If the situation is a kohen and the lost item is in the cemetery, pshita. What does pshita mean?
Simple.
Simple or obvious. This is obvious that a kohen wouldn't do that. How is it obvious? Obvious meaning you don't need a pasuk for it. Hai ase v'hai lo ta'ase v'ase. One is a mitzvah ase, an active commandment to go bring back the lost item. And the other is not only a prohibition of going into the cemetery, but also an ase. What's the other ase?
Not become pure.
Well, you can't use the word not if we're talking about a positive commandment.
To remain
pure. To remain pure.
Kedoshim to you.
Good. Well, close.
Or to remain
good. Good. Let's look at Rashi. What does Rashi say? Lo ta'ase v'ase. The last line in the Rashi letters on the inside. Well, you don't have an inside of the page. On the right side of your page. Lenefesh lo yitama. That's one pasuk. To a soul, you should not become impure. And kedoshim yihyu. Kedoshim Tihyu is to all of the Jewish people, and that's not specifically to the Kohen. That's the beginning of Kedoshim. Kedoshim Yihyu is a reference to Kohanim specifically. Now, there is a debate amongst the Rishonim. When you have, and this is a little far afield for us, but when you have a mitzvah, and the mitzvah itself has two aspects to it, one which is stated in the positive, one just stated in the negative, there is always going to be a debate. First, are those two separate mitzvahs? Do we count them as two separate mitzvahs, or are they the same mitzvah just bolstered from both sides? That's number one. Number two is, if we're going to claim that they're two separate mitzvahs, are there any situations where one would apply and the other doesn't? Because if there's no situation where one would apply and the other doesn't, so it might be that they would still be counted under the same rubric of a mitzvah. Now that's far afield. But there's a Tosfos in Kiddushin that talks about this concept and brings up Hashavas Aveda. Is there a situation where, on the one hand, well, this is talking about the Kohen. Is there a situation on the one hand where you can apply Lenefesh Lo Yitama, that you can't become impure, but you wouldn't apply Kedoshim Yihyu? It's not exactly clear what that situation could be. Nonetheless, the Gemara here says, Rabbi Katz, take the math equation that you said last week and throw it out the window. Because it's obvious that a Kohen can't go into a cemetery. Why is it obvious? On the one hand, you have the positive mitzvah, return a lost item. On the other hand, you have not only a prohibition, a negative commandment, you also have a positive commandment. So therefore, it's no longer a one versus a one. We can't say anymore that love trumps fear. Because it's love trumping fear and love, you can't do that, right? Fear counts for something. So if you're going to give points to love on the one hand, you got to give the same points to love on the other hand. So love of doing a proactive mitzvah does not outweigh love and fear of doing a proactive mitzvah and doing a negative mitzvah. Now, there's something that you could disagree with in this equation. Based on how I'm saying it, at least in the words in English, You could disagree. What could you disagree with? I'm using the phrases active and non-active or inactive. Right? On the one hand, a positive mitzvah means you're active, you're doing something. And a negative commandment means you're inactive. You're refraining, you're not doing anything.
What's active about being kadosh?
But
exactly.
Kadosh
is
active. Yeah.
Kadosh means you just sit there, don't go into the cemetery.
Not true.
And by result, you're kadosh.
Not true.
Okay, how do you become kadosh for a kohen?
There are things that you do to maintain kedusha, and to...
Even in your own words, you said the word maintain. Maintain means to keep, not to attain. Attain would be to something you have to do, right? So what do you have to do as a kohen to become kadosh?
I mean, there are certain ways
there are certain ways you can become untame.
Right.
But that's only once you're tame. Right? If you are already kadosh, you're already pure, you're already tahor.
But there are going to be instances where you're going to be tame, whether you want to or not.
Yeah. And then the requirement is to become tahor again. Yeah. But that's not included in the pasuk of Kedoshim Yehiyu.
So isn't to prevent something from happening active? For example, preventative health. I'm going to go exercise to prevent a heart attack.
Right.
Okay? That is very active.
Yeah, we would call that active.
Right, so to...
The actual mitzvah,
to prevent becoming impure, you have to be actively protecting your purity.
Okay.
Okay, think about, you know, sneeze.
Mm-hmm.
You know, am I automatically sneeze? Pretty much, but I have to...
Buy the right clothes.
And you,
it could come along with, and this is going
to,
and this is going to come to really, to a little bit of a, and this actually is, it is relevant, but not for tonight, maybe for next week, that it might come to, when does the fulfillment of something kick in? Does the fulfillment of something kick in when you do it, or when it's the resultant of something you do? So for instance, when do you get the mitzvah of shaking a lulav? When you're shaking it. When do you get, and this is going to be a strange example, but it's actually a big discussion. When do you get the mitzvah of bris milah? Not when you're cutting.
After it's done.
You are now mahul. Mm-hmm. Once you're in a state of circumcised, then you get a mitzvah. So in terms of defining when you actually get the mitzvah, there are certain mitzvahs that are active, there are certain mitzvahs that are sort of active, but only kick in once you're already done. So it could be that you have a lot of preventative steps to take that require action, but you get the mitzvah once you finish the action, not while you're doing the action. You know what I'm saying?
Right.
So this is discussed by a lot of mitzvahs, by, for instance, shechita. What's the mitzvah of shechita? The mitzvah of shechita is to not to shecht. The mitzvah of shechita is to eat a shechted animal.
Oh, no.
Right? So this is why there's a discussion about...
There is a mitzvah involved with the shechita too.
Right, but the fulfillment of the mitzvah is not the act. It's more of what we call an iser asay. And this is getting way far afield. But it's the mitzvah is to have a kosher animal. To have a...
But the shechit itself involves certain things.
Yeah, it requires an act. And this is why it's a little more advanced.
Not just an act, but a preparation for
Yes, but the fulfillment of the mitzvah is having a shechted animal, not shechting the animal.
So would you apply that to putting up a mezuzah?
Yes.
It isn't until
the mitzvah of the mitzvah is to have the mezuzah up, not to put the mezuzah on. So it gets confusing, but...
Nevertheless, you say the bracha when you're...
Yeah,
when you're putting
yeah.
It,
so if I have somebody put the mezuzah up on my house, I still get the mitzvah.
Yes, but you should do it yourself so that you can say the bracha. You can't say the bracha if an andrew does it.
Okay.
Yeah, I think. Unless we, like, punish someone who doesn't... Whatever. I don't know. It should be okay, but you shouldn't do it. either way, so here the question becomes, one could ask the question, that was a long tangent to say, one could ask the question, but Kedoshim Yehiyu is inactive, but it's still a fulfillment of a mitzvah saseh. When exactly do you get that fulfillment is actually a very relevant question. When does a Kohen fulfill the mitzvah of being Kadosh?
After he goes into the Beit HaMikdash? I mean,
what if he can't?
No, he's already Kadosh as a Kohen. The obligation to be Kadosh is an ongoing status. You can lose it if you do the wrong thing.
You go to the mikvah.
Right, and then you have to regain it.
Right.
But that you don't get a mitzvah for going to the mikvah.
Okay.
You just... So this is also something that we call an iser asay.
Wow.
It's a mitzvah which is active, I mean, because it's phrased in the positive. Mm-hmm. You should be holy... But the only time it ever comes into effect is when you don't do something. I mean, you can violate it, but you can never really fulfill it actively. But there's still a mitzvah that's constantly incumbent upon a person to actively refrain from violating it. Right? So
that would apply to every negative commandment.
Well, negative commandment for sure. for sure that it applies to negative commandments. Here, the newness of this is that it applies even to positive commandments. The same thing by eating non-kosher animals. It's a mitzvah aseh, if I'm not mistaken, to eat kosher animals.
Yeah.
So how do you fulfill the mitzvah of eating kosher animals? Not by eating a shechted animal, but you can violate it by eating a non-kosher animal. So that's sort of how it works. Either way, it's a hard thing to really to wrap your head around. But here, the point for us is we have a positive commandment and it cannot outrule a negative and a positive commandment. So says the Gemara, if you have a 1 versus a 2, you're not going to win. And therefore, you don't need a pasuk. You told me that the pasuk teaches me that a Kohen doesn't have to go into the cemetery. If he talamta mehem, you're allowed to hide yourself from it. You don't have to go into the cemetery. I don't need the pasuk to tell me that. The rules of Aseh Dochalot Aseh already tell me that. So why do I need that? The Gemara, however, goes further. The Gemara says, Ilam evizgaros v'hi b'vesekros pshita. Hai Aseh v'hai lo taseh v'aseh. V'lo ati Aseh v'dachiet lo taseh v'aseh. And we have a rule that we don't push away two things with only one thing. By the way, some of the Rishonim asked another question on this, which is a fascinating question. Based on the math. How many mitzvahs are there in returning a lost item?
It's got to be a trick question.
It can't just be one. And we talked about this 2 weeks ago. There's one mitzvah of returning a lost item, and then there's also...
mitzvah maintaining
it. No, okay, well, that's part of the mitzvah.
Okay.
And there's also a lotase to not hide yourself from it. Right? Do you remember this? If you see a lost item, you're not allowed to turn away from it. So ask some of the Rishonim, including the Ritva right here. Wait a second. That's not 1 versus a 2. It's a 2 versus a 2. You have a mitzvah, aseh, proactive to do it, and a lota, aseh, a negative commitment to not do it. Versus the 2 for the Kohen. So he says, why don't those count? So most of the Rishonim say, because when we're talking about pushing away other mitzvahs, you can only push things away by an act, not by a non-act.
Or an inaction.
Right. So that's part of the discussion, but we're not even going to talk about that right now.
So forget what we just heard.
But two, and then the Gemara adds another statement. If you look at the second to last line, the second word is vitu. Anyone know what vitu means? It means... and furthermore, and also in Aramaic speak, lo dachinan isura mikame mamona. What does that mean? Lo, we know the word lo. No. We do not dachinan.
Push
like
off.
Docha, we don't push off. Isura.
For reasons, monetary reasons.
A forbidden thing, mikame mamona.
For money.
For money. What does that mean? What does that mean?
Well, the pragmatic, the secular.
About someone where the amount of money that they would be losing by returning
okay.
it.
It's good thinking. It's good
push
thinking.
Away the but it's wrong. Spiritual.
That's a good drasha, but that's not what it's saying here. But what it means is isura, meaning we can't push away a prohibition by the means of a monetary commandment. Meaning here we have two categories of mitzvahs. On the one hand, we have a category of mitzvah which is called, what we say, Isser V'Heter. What's Isser V'Heter? Things that Hashem says we're not allowed to do. Not because we necessarily understand them with our own mind, but because Hashem told us. It's sort of like a chok. So what's the Isser in this situation? A Kohen can't become impure. That's the Isser. That's a prohibition. That's in the category of something which Hashem tells us to do for the sake of spiritual reasons or for the sake of just things that we can't understand fully. So when it comes to a prohibition of that nature, we can't take a monetary consideration and conclude that that's more important than a spiritual prohibition. If you have a monetary issue, which would include the returning of a lost object, someone's property, so the consideration of that property, we can't assume is more important than the prohibition itself, the prohibition of impurity. So says the Gemara, lo dachinan isura mikami mamona. Just because somebody lost an item doesn't mean that that item is more important than something that Hashem says is prohibited. Right? So the way that I phrased that was more of a rational way to phrase it. There are some people that would have phrased it otherwise and just say, like, Hashem said this, your mind said this, whatever. There's different ways of
presenting. What you're basically saying is a Kohen shouldn't go into something. It's very, very expensive object that he sees in the cemetery, right. Diamond ring, let's say, or something like that. And it would be a great loss to somebody. But that shouldn't be the reason why he says, I have to go get it. Is that what you're saying?
Right. Well, it was sort of. Meaning that when it comes to dichoy, when it comes to pushing things off, when you have, you know, a tension between which one's more important. So when it comes to an iser, when it comes to a prohibition, that's always going to be tantamount. It's always going to be more important than any monetary consideration. Just in terms of how do we do this calculus? What's more important? So that's how the value of the prohibition is always going to weigh heavier than the value of the monetary, even if it's a mitzvah. Even if it's a mitzvah. So
can I ask, in the event of saving a life?
That's the most important, yeah?
Yeah.
That's not monetary. I mean, There could be monetary consequences, but...
Yeah, I'm thinking you're allowed to break Shabbos.
Yeah. Well, that's not for monetary reasons, right? That's right.
And these are things, not people.
Right, here we're talking about things, like an item you found. Yeah, if there was Chas V'Shalom something in a cemetery that you'd have to go pick up, the coin should go pick it up too. Actually relevant to today's daf also.
Well, let's say it's Erev Shabbos, and in order mm-hmm. to go get the object, you're not a Kohen, it's not a cemetery issue, mm-hmm. but it will involve time mm-hmm. to obtain the object for various reasons. Maybe you go down a stairway, maybe you got to uncover a...
And Shabbos is going to start, is that what you're saying?
Yeah, so you're mm-hmm. faced with, do I...
Right. You shouldn't put yourself in the situation if you don't have to.
You value Shabbos over that monetary object.
Yeah.
I would agree with that.
Yeah. Obviously, every situation is going to be different, and there are a lot of details that would change based on the given circumstance, but that's the general rule. So what we find here is really something the Gemara oftentimes tries not to do. And when it does it, it questions it. What I mean by that is, the Gemara just gave us two distinct, independent answers to why we don't need a pasuk. Right? The Gemara said, why do we need this pasuk? Which teaches me that a Kohen doesn't have to go into a cemetery. And in the end, the Gemara gives us two answers, which really don't have much. They have a little bit to do with each other, but they don't have much. One is, the math doesn't work. It's a one versus a two. And the other is, the categories don't work. You're trying to override a prohibition with a monetary consideration. You can't do that. Two separate answers. And the Gemara oftentimes, when it has an answer, will give us one answer, and that'll suffice. And if the Gemara somehow refutes that answer, it'll give us another answer. And if the Gemara gives us two answers, oftentimes the Gemara will say, why'd you give me two answers? In this situation, however, it doesn't ask that question. So the question remains unanswered for the Rishonim to deal with. And the Rishonim ask, why do we have two answers here? In one way or another, that's how they ask it. So who are the Rishonim? Rashi is a Rishon. Tosfos is a Rishon, or group of Rishonim. The Rashba, the Ritva, the Ran, the Rush, the Maharami Ruttenberg, the Riva, Rabbeinu Tam, right? All these people that we've heard their names. So this is the Ritva. Anyone know who the Ritva was? The Ritva, his name was Rabbi Yom Tov. His name is Yom Tov. It's a pretty good name. I guess his parents were happy that day. It's Yom Tov. No, that wasn't the name. That was just what I said. Okay, anyway. Rav Yom Tov, his father's name was Ashvili in Arabic. Right? Ashvili. Also known as Avraham in Hebrew. Yom Tov, the Ritva. Rav Yom Tov ben Ashvili. Or ben Avraham. I believe that's right. I haven't looked at this in a long time. But Rav Yom Tov ben Ashvili. Alashvili. Could be Avram Alashvili. Okay. It's both Hebrew and Arabic. So he lives in generally Spain, if I'm not mistaken. He comes from the great line of Sephardic rabbis in Spain. So people like the Ramban and the Rashba and the Ran and the Riva and the Rivash. The Rambam was there, but he sort of made his way to Egypt, so he's not really part of this clan. He gets out before that big group. So the Ritva is, I think, in the third generation. And he lived, I think he was born at the end of the 13th century, but mostly in the 14th century. I'm not going to say it here. You can look it up yourself. But the Ritva is, in many ways, the most comprehensive authority or commentary on the Sephardic opinions, because he comes later, right? He's after the Ramban and after the Ran and after the Rashba, and therefore he's learning in the same places as these great rabbis, and he has all of their commentaries to talk about and to observe and to work out himself and to really give over himself in tradition. So that's why the Ritva's commentary is oftentimes much more thorough and comprehensive than you would see in the Ramban or the Ran. Because he has all of them, he oftentimes quotes all of them and he discusses them. He happens to also have a little more of a colloquial style, so he talks about it a little more. But either way, the Ramban here, he asks this question. Sort of. Well, he addresses this question. He doesn't ask it explicitly. So the Ritva asks or addresses this question from a different angle. And that is, there's a big, big problem with this Gemara. I was just watching a movie, or I hired a non-Jew to watch a movie for me. And he told me that in this movie, They had a scene. What was the movie? A movie some people here are probably familiar with, because they showed it here a couple years ago for the movie night, which is why I thought of watching it, called The Women's Balcony. Mm-hmm. And in this movie, if you remember, fascinating theological movie. I really love the questions. I don't love the answers as much. The questions were great. And it's about basically the group of women in Yerushalayim where their shul, the women's section, the balcony fell in, and they had to get more money. And the rabbi was old; he was losing his memory and everything. And basically, they get this young whippersnapper to be their rabbi, or at least he makes himself their rabbi. And he's a lot more stringent, a lot less flexible, and. They collect all this money to repair the balcony. And the rabbi takes the money and he's going to use it to buy a Sefer Torah. Because the Sefer Torah is apparently more important than the women being in shul. And there are obviously halachic considerations to that and halachic considerations that go beyond that. Not for now. Either way, in this one scene, so he's discussing with the husbands of these wives, who are all very upset, as you can imagine. And this is really a turning point, this scene.
Who, the women or the husbands are upset?
The husbands have become upset because of the situation. Not as upset as the women, obviously. Right. But he's talking to the husbands.
And they know they're going to have to go home and
explain this. Right. That's the worst part for them.
That's right. That's where their upset comes from.
Yeah, it's a really good scene in the movie. But either way, so they're talking to the rabbi, and they said, you know, rabbi, or room to be flexible, you know, room, whatever. And the rabbi says to them, I think this is what he said, if a child had a blemish and he had saras on a place where he gets a bris milah, right? So what do? He says this to the men. So what do? He says, you have to give the bris milah and cut off the saras.
Oh my gosh.
Now technically, you're not allowed to cut off tzaras. It's a biblical prohibition. It's a very strange example to use. But why is he using it? He was saying to the guys, on the one hand, yes, we want the women to be in shul. But on the other hand, we need the Sefer Torah. So while we get a Sefer Torah, we have to be cutting off this consideration. Right? And that was basically, you know, his pitch to the men. Like, we can get rid of the women for the sake of a Sefer Torah. Right? At least for the time being. Now, that whole concept of cutting off the tzaras for the sake of a bris milah, brings with it a very important idea. And this is basically, he's quoting a Gemara in Shabbos. Happens to be, I don't know if the guy himself is from. Does anyone know the actor?
No.
Ricky said that he's from...
the guy who wrote the play.
He wrote the book?
No, I mean whoever wrote it is...
Oh, yeah, you're right, right, right. I'm just saying that the actor doesn't probably know what he's talking about.
Exactly.
But,
like Stissel.
Right. Some of them are from Stissel, no?
No.
None of them are from?
None of them is. None of them is.
None of them?
None.
I thought I looked into it.
Nope.
Either way.
But the one who wrote it...
I'm just waiting for season three.
...knows what he's writing about.
Either way. So this guy who is apparently... an actor in another very popular show called Baker and the Beauty, or Beauty and the Baker. Anyone know this? Anyone talking about?
Yes.
Okay, talk to the Rebbetzin about it. Either way, where does he get this idea from? He gets it from Gemara and Shabbos. The Gemara and Shabbos tells us that if you have the situation, you're allowed to cut off the tzaras for the sake of the bris milah. But the Gemara brings from that a very important idea, which is that if you want to overrule a prohibition by doing a mitzvah, so there's what we learn from this case is a non-negotiable condition to it, which is that they have to happen at the same exact time. Meaning, if I were to cut off tzaras next to the bris milah and then do the bris milah, that wouldn't be good. Because you're not accomplishing the mitzvah at the same time that you're transgressing the prohibition. That in order to do it, you have to do them at the same time. You can't push one away if you're not accomplishing the other at the same time. So now, let me ask you a question. What is the opinion of our Gemara in terms of when you can push something away? Remember, I introduced this in some ways 2 weeks ago when we started this topic. When do you accomplish the mitzvah of Hashavas Aveda? When you return it. The Gemara just said, we don't need a pasuk to tell me that a Kohen can't go into the cemetery. Why? Because it's an Aseh which is trying to push off an Aseh and a Lotaseh. It's a one versus a two. You can't do it.
So you need to tell you when to go into the cemetery.
But there's a much, much simpler answer as to why he can't go into the cemetery. Not because it's a one versus a two.
Because going to the cemetery doesn't accomplish the mitzvah.
Because he's going to a cemetery, he's going to become impure, and he's not even close to accomplishing a mitzvah. He's not even close to it. By the time he steps 1 foot over the line, like Field of Dreams, when he steps over that line, he's becoming impure. I don't know if anyone got that reference. But you're becoming impure the second you step over the line. You haven't even approached the lost item. Not to mention you haven't picked it up. Not to mention you haven't walked out. Not to mention you haven't brought it back to the guy. You haven't found the guy. And all of a sudden the Gemara is proposing, then maybe Asa Dochalot Asa, no, you can't do it because it's really Asa Dochalot Asa and an Asa. That's why it doesn't work. Because it's a one versus a two. If it was a one versus a one, maybe it would work. But this is a one versus a two, so we can't do it. Ask all of the Rishonim, what do you mean it's a one versus a two and that's why you can't do it? It's not even one versus anything. You're transgressing the prohibition the second you step into the cemetery.
You don't even know you're going to find the owner.
You don't even know, yeah. You don't even know if you can accomplish the mitzvah yet. So how can you claim to me that this is a one versus a one or now a one versus a two? The whole equation doesn't make sense. How are you ever going to do that? So this is the Ritva's implicit question. He says, "V'im b'she lo natla dain v'haveda b'beis hakvaras." I'm just saying it outside. So then, if you're going to say, "Im yishum shayasofu l'kaimo im yitlena," maybe you're going to say you're going to accomplish the mitzvah later on, and therefore you can assume that it's an aseh dochalot aseh. So no, eino ra'oi lidchos. Kevan, you can't push it away because deki akar lilav, when you uproot or transgress the prohibition, lo mikayim ase, you're not also fulfilling the ase, the positive commandment. Says the Ritva, how can we even propose this possibility? Says the Ritva, v'yesh lomar dilaravcha nakat. Dilaravcha nakat. Anyone know what revach means? More. Right? Revach means like an expanse. You're giving revach v'atzala. Right? You're giving more. Revach de la rav chanaka. They're just giving another possibility. They're expanding the realm of their argument. They're expanding their response. But really, it's not a good answer. Really, it wouldn't work. Which is why, if you come back to what I started with 20 minutes ago, that's why we have two answers. Because one of them doesn't work. Says Rifa, that's why the Gemara gives another answer. Because it knows the first one's no good. It's a crazy statement from the Ritva.
Yeah,
the Gemara gives us an answer that it knows doesn't work. There was a Rosh Yeshiva of YU. His name was Rav Ozer Glickman Tzatzal. And I don't know if you're familiar with Rabbi Glickman. Was he here before? Yeah, he was related to someone.
His wife grew up here.
Somebody told me this. Someone told me there was a connection. Yeah. Either way, so Rabbi Ozer Glickman is one of those like beyond nature people. Like it doesn't, like you see, he's like an alien. He says he slept 2 hours a night. He was like a big successful banker on Wall Street, and he worked all day and then he learned all night. And he like never slept. And he was one of these philosophy gurus. And at the same time, no one knew him. Like if you were in the Smicha program at YU, he just did his own thing. He was one of those really lishma type of guys. He did his own thing because he wanted to. He didn't need the pomp and circumstance of being a teacher to everybody and speaking in the yeshiva all the time. But I remember at YU, because I had to stay in YU for a number of reasons, for Shabbos. So they would always have, the guest speaker would always give a Q&A. And at this Q&A, we were all like, he became revealed to the student body at this Q&A. I just remember it was like 3 hours long, and everybody just like, who is this guy? He keeps talking. There's more wisdom and more. It was just unbelievable. But one of the things he said was, oftentimes when he speaks to someone in philosophy, and they're bothering him with some claim or whatever, so sometimes he knows the correct answer. The correct answer, however, will take him a long time to explain, and the person's not going to understand it right away. But he knows there's another answer which is simpler that the other person would be satisfied. So oftentimes he'll give the person the one answer which he knows is wrong just to get the guy to stop bothering him.
Oh my.
Even though he knows there's a real answer to it. That's what he said to us. Like for someone to be able to actually think that way and to already know what the other person would accept and already know that it's wrong and that there's another answer, that's like way beyond how I think. But he said sometimes he'll just give an answer which he knows is wrong to satisfy that person, to placate him. So, lahavdil. But that's what it sounds like the Ritva is telling us. That the Gemara gives us two answers, one which it knows is not good. One which it knows it has problems. L'rav chanakat, delomi baya, we don't need the k'disala aveda v'esa k'varos kodem shenatla t'leka elot ha'say ala afilo natla k'var. So he's saying maybe even if, the Ritva says, it's really just trying to give us another element to it. That if you could concoct a case where the fulfillment of the mitzvah happens at the exact time that you would step into the cemetery, even then it wouldn't work. That's what the Ritva is saying. If you could somehow concoct, how exactly does that work? Unclear. The Ritva is saying, it's not really an answer, but it's just to bolster what we already know, which is, it doesn't work. You can't do it. And that's basically okay. He gives other details, but the Ritva points out that very important question, which is it doesn't happen at the same time. All of this is to come to our introduction for next week, because as you know, this class is not just learning Gemara, but it's halacha from Gemara. We've spent 3 weeks focusing on a very specific aspect of the Gemara's analysis of one line in the Mishnah. One of the questions that we started with, and that we reiterated in some ways today, is when does the mitzvah start? And this, what we are going through today is something which is going to get us there in a wee bit. But according to the Ritva, what we just saw is the mitzvah of Hashabbos Aveda is not even fulfilled until you give it to the person. And therefore, this line in the Gemara doesn't really work. Because when he walks into the Beis HaKaros, when he walks into the cemetery, he's already prohibited, he's already transgressing the prohibition, and he's not even close to fulfilling the mitzvah. So you would think, with that understanding, with that concept of the mitzvah of returning a lost item, the fact that it doesn't apply until later, that it should be that all halachic decisors, anyone who brings down the conclusion of this Gemara, anyone who codifies the rules of Hashavas Aveda, should never even make mention of this line in the Gemara. It should never even be in thought process. It should never come up in conversation, because as the Ritva says, it makes no sense. However, one of the greatest codifiers in Jewish history, if not the greatest codifier in Jewish history, the Rambam himself, Maimonides, says exactly this logic, exactly this equation in his Sefer of Halacha, the Mishnah Torah. And everyone is baffled. Rambam, don't you know the Halacha from Saras and Bris Mila? The thing has to happen at the same time. This isn't even close to the same time. Why are you bringing this logic? So hopefully next week, we will take a step through the Gemara, into the Rambam, and try to figure out how does the Rambam understand this line in the Gemara, and hopefully understand a little bit better what is the mitzvah of returning a lost item. When does it start, when does it end, and how does it apply? So come back next week to figure out how we understand the Rambam. Okay.
Thank you.